The next item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from the August 31st, 2020 meeting. Do we have a motion?
Move for approval.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. Item number three is public comment. If you are here to speak, just go ahead and come up to the podium one at a time. You have 2 minutes to speak. Please state your name and address for the record.
George Freeman, 1450 Bowman Road. I'm here to speak again about the rezoning of the property in Six Mile. I hope this is the last time, this is not going to be deferred again. But I don't have anything new to say except that we're still against it, against the rezoning. We're not that concerned about the annexation, but we are against the rezoning. And we'd appreciate that everybody respects the community and deny the rezoning. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone? Go for it.
Good afternoon. I'm George Bixler at 144 Third Avenue, Mount Pleasant. I'm here to speak on behalf of the short-term rentals. It seems 10 years ago we started this process, and I thought we had it nailed down and finalized with a pretty good set of guidelines and policies. But for some reason or another, it seems to come off the rails. And I'm here to encourage the council and this committee, rather, to adhere to the policies and procedures that were put in place a year ago. There's no need to reopen the can of worms. It works if you enforce it. You have all the power and all the rules to enforce the guidelines to make short-term rentals work. I've been coming to these meetings for 10 years, several mayors ago, many council members ago, and I think we have a program that works. Let's make it work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Cindy Watts, and speaking about the Six Mile property for annexation. That property was started by my father-in-law 40 years ago. His desire to provide affordable housing for families and to invest in a retirement for himself and his sons. So it passed to his sons at his death, and they have now been operating for 25 years. The past 2 years, it has become increasingly difficult. Out of the three sons, one is deceased. The other two are disabled and are not able medically to participate. Our nephew has helped some as he can after his father died. I have started stepping in trying to help with management and the operations, but I also have a disabled son and I'm guardian for an aunt with Alzheimer's. So our family situation has come to the point that we're no longer able to continue with this business. And the difficult decision has been made that it's time for the guys to retire and that we need to dissolve the company. To do that, we have to close the mobile home park, which was very difficult because it's a part of our family. But we can't continue to operate. The tenants have, that's been the hardest part, is closing it for the tenants, but their lease is 30 days, and that's what we were advised is the norm in this situation, but we can't do that. Some have been there for decades. So we have been very transparent back in the spring that we're having to look at options. And then in the summer, a written notice that we had decided to move forward and sell, and we keep them informed. And then we have sent notice, 5.5 months notice, that the park will be closing February the 1st, 2021. So that part we're kind of working with. It is also their responsibility to relocate their home.
Ma'am, I'm sorry, your 2 minutes is up.
Let's finish up. We just have two minutes, that's all. Thank you.
So we have also retained a consultant for them. I'm sorry, I thought you were on the phone.
Okay. Please finish.
We have retained a consultant to help them with this process. And now we are coming to you. We are not developers.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we really don't know.
We're asking for annexation to keep the property characteristic to what y'all would want and the Watts family would want.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for having me and listening to me. My name's John Bench. I'm a lifelong resident. I was born and raised here in the Old Village. My wife and I have, we've owned a home here for over 30 years. And we're kind of downsizing, and I'm speaking on behalf of short-term rentals. I own short-term rental right now. I do actively have my house up for sale. And anyhow, I bought a townhouse in the Waterway Arms in November, and it seemed like we had a sale. We chose Waterway Arms because we didn't want to leave the area. Our family lives here. We have friends and family that have lived in Waterway Arms area, and we wanted a safe place for our daughter to come home to. We knew there were short-term rentals there, and we have plans, eventual plans, to travel for a portion of the year while having a little income when I retire. But when the sale of our home fell through, we began the short-term rental of our townhouse. And it's got a business license, it's totally legal, and we began short-term rentals. Well, we only list with Airbnb, and we have strict guidelines. We don't rent to those under 25, we limit occupants to 4, and we do not allow house parties or loud music. We usually greet our guests, check in with them often, and drive by the house because we live right down the street. These guests have been some of the nicest people we've ever met, and they have, however, been screamed at repeatedly by our neighbor for parking a few inches over onto her property or her parking area. And accidentally, a tenant put some pizza in one of her garbage cans, which she leaves out. And that was a mistake. Well, she ended up screaming at them, bringing them to tears. She never asked nicely. There's a nice way and there's a hard way. And anyhow, she doesn't know the nice way.
Sir.
And because of these extensive harassments, she calls police for very minor things that most people would never bother with.
Sir, please finish up. It's 2 minutes.
Anyhow, to sum things up, we've had police call because of children going up and down the steps. I don't think that's entitled to, loud music or, obsessive noise. At any rate,
sir,
I just want to have my say and let y'all know I'm speaking on behalf of short-term rentals. Thank you.
Good evening. My name's Chris Donato. I'm at 1250 Fairmont Avenue. I am a representative of Mrs. Watts, and I'm speaking for her annexation. I'm just going to give you some detailed reasons why we believe that this is a no-brainer for the town to bring into the town and to zone this appropriately. Currently, this piece of property has 31 homes on it today. This is not a new development. We consider this a renovation. This is an older development that needs to be brought up to modern times. Right now in the Charleston County, if they stay in Charleston County, yes, Charleston County has 12,500 square foot minimum lots. They do not have an open space requirement, and their density will be the same at 3 units per acre. With the proposal that we have, the lots are smaller at an R4 minimum, but we are having 30% open space, which accounts for 2.79 acres, which is currently not there. And yes, R4 allows 4,000 square foot lots. That is not possible on this piece of property. We've done a plan. We've been through DRT. The smallest lot that we could get on this piece of property is 6,500 square feet due to the lot width ratio requirement from the town. So 4,000 is not even an option on this piece of property. And I spoke about the open space. Currently, there's 0 acres of open space. In Charleston County, there will remain 0 acres of open space. With this plan, we're at 2.79 acres. When I was here for the Water Supply Committee, and I felt like the Water Supply Committee was talking about this piece of property specifically. Why? There are 31 homes on septic tanks on this site today. All those homes drain to the Christchurch Creek at the rear of the property. This is a chance that we can bring this into town and clean that up and get rid of the septic tanks on this piece of property. And also, Mr. DeMore mentioned fairness of taxation. Right now, there's 31 homes not in the fairness of taxation as you speak to. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
We're here if you have any questions when this item comes up on the agenda. Thank you.
Is there anyone else here for public comment? All right. Moving on to the next item of business is 4A, the rezoning Carolina Park Recreation Center.
It's changing up there. Okay. Okay. Sorry, it's changing on your monitor, but it's not changing on our computer, so we're just trying to get up. While Jeff does that, I'm going to go ahead and start. So this is old business. This actually came to the Planning Commission back in June. At that time, the Planning Commission recommended that there was a motion made to approve, and that motion failed 3-3. So it essentially was sent forward with no recommendation. It is an amendment to the Carolina Park Plan Development District Ordinance, specifically pertaining to the piece of property, which I will show you in just a minute, and particularly pertaining to the Carolina Park land use table. The request is to allow communication towers as a conditional use, thanks Martine, in the Carolina Park in the Carolina Park Active Park District. So, and why I said it pertains to this particular piece of property here, this is if you're headed towards Faison Road, towards Oceanside Collegiate Academy, you take a right on Recreation Way, I believe, and it's the soccer complex back there. This is the only parcel within all of the Carolina Park PD that has this designation for Carolina Park Active Park. It is a town park. It's the only property within the development that has this designation, and they would like to amend the land use table for this development to allow the communications facilities on this zoning district. If this amendment is approved, it would allow a 120-foot monopole with a concealed wireless facility. This would be a conditional use requirement set forth in zoning code sections 156113 through 120. So it would be allowed in this zoning district on this property, subject to all of the town's conditional use requirements. And those are pretty extensive. I've listed them all in the PowerPoint, and they are all in the staff report that was attached in your packet. Here's the property, and the applicant is here, and he can give more detail to that in a minute, but you can kind of see where Recreation Way comes into the parking lot, and down where that red X is the general area of where they would put that monopole. One of the more important things when we do look at these conditional uses is the fall zone. And one of those conditions is that the minimum setback from the center of the tower to an adjacent residentially zoned property is equal to the height of the tower measured to the closest property line. Just a rough measurement of this one, it appears the nearest residence is a distance of no less than 600 feet from the center of the proposed tower. And anything not addressed in this proposed amendment, we would revert back to the original PD ordinance and then to the town's ordinances. This would be required to go through our design review team, and it would get all staff review that would be required as part of the permitting process. And that's all I have, unless y'all have any questions.
Okay. Do you have any questions? Do we have a motion?
I'll move for approval.
Second.
All right, we're in discussion. Is there any discussion of this?
Are they going to give a presentation or? Nope. I mean, I'm just asking.
Oh, is your mic?
Oh. Was there going to be a presentation on this again or no? No? The applicant is here, and perhaps if it's okay with you, I think he would like to say a few words. He does have a map he would like to show.
Ms. Whitley, was that Ms. Corley that seconded?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jonathan Yates here today with my good friend and colleague Keith Powell about my towers. First and foremost, I know the hour is late. The afternoon is stretched on, so I will not stretch it. people say it sometimes takes me 5 minutes to say my own name. But first and foremost, I want to thank the town of Mount Pleasant for working with us on this important project, from Marcy in finance, Eric, Christiane, David on legal, Julia before him on legal, and then of course to Jeff and Michelle. What we're proposing, and this has been an interesting year for everyone in this country, everyone in the room, everyone in this country. What we're proposing is to improve wireless infrastructure in the surrounding area. That is it, pure and simple. We saw a lot happen this year. What we saw a lot of was wireless networks being strained. A lot of folks were at home. They were home to take care of their kids, to try to school them, and they were also trying to conduct business from home, usually through a wireless network. So this has become more and more important. What we propose here is not dissimilar to what Keith did a few years back that this council approved at Rivertown. Only difference here, we're coming in about 10 feet shorter. In this case, we would do what is called a monopole style tower. What is a monopole? It's just like a pylon you'd have in front of a Hardee's or a Walmart, but instead we put communication equipment on it. In order to meet the context of the sports fields, what you usually see at the base of a monopole is an 8 to 10 foot chain link fence and then the carrier equipment. What we're proposing is an architecturally designed building that we'll work with the town on to get it right for the context. Keith and I took a look a couple months ago at what the town did at Shem Creek. Good looking buildings, we might try to emulate that. But to give you a feel, this is initially for T-Mobile. T-Mobile has a severe issue in the area that they want to try to rectify. It is designed, however, though, so that all of their competitors, the other broadband carriers in the market, can also deploy from here. We're looking at this really as a win-win. The folks will get wireless infrastructure and all that means. And what does wireless infrastructure mean? It means for folks like me, getting to talk on my phone a lot, getting to access data. But if you call the folks at the Charleston County Consolidated Dispatch for 911, they will tell you that 84% of all 911 calls, I can't say that quickly, I always add another one, I'm sorry, come from a wireless device. This is particularly important where people are playing, where things happen. Again, if you look at what we achieved at Rivertown, if you drive out there today, you may or may not be able to see it. We have in this deck some photo simulations. Can you scroll up a little bit? This is great. I get to tell her what to do because I will goof it up. Okay. There was.
Committee, well, do you feel that the need for further discussion? Do you feel for more information at this point?
Do you guys?
No.
Are you guys going to have any other questions? No. You're good. I feel good about.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're pretty well versed on this one. So,
if there are any questions, we're right here.
All right. Thank you so much. And I would like to say I think I'm comfortable with this because it's so far from anything sort of residential or school. It's got a nice buffer there because I would hesitate to put anything closer than that.
That was where I was having some issues, but now that I've seen exactly where they're going to place it, it's away from all playing fields, away from any residential.
Yeah. All right. Are we ready to vote?
Yeah.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carried. We will recommend to council that we do this rezoning. Item 4B is a request to annex the 11.54 tract at 6 Mile Road. This has been deferred multiple times, and we've heard a lot about this, but mm-hmm. If you would like to say a few... I'm talking to Michelle, sorry. If you would like to say a few things about this.
Yes, ma'am. So this was deferred twice. It came to, I think, to the August Planning Commission, where the recommendation was... to deny the proposal. So the first part of this, we've combined it, but the first part of this is annexation of an approximately 11.54 acre tract of land located at 1246 Mile Road. The comprehensive plan does call for community conservation. You can see it there off of 6 Mile. And there's the community conservation future land use designation. And here you can see the surrounding zoning. So it's got some CC in the back and some R4 adjacent with some R1 up on the street. They are requesting to be zoned R4. There's currently 31 manufactured homes on the lot. And that's all for the annexation unless you have questions.
I do have a question. If we approve the annexation, The property automatically comes in as community conservation, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. So automatic, if they weren't requesting anything, it's also recommended for the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District, but our ordinance does not automatically designate an overlay. So you can see here, this is our Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District. It's a little bit difficult to see, but the red hatch is every property within the boundaries that is actually included in the overlay, and then those that are within the boundary that are not hatched are not within the overlay. So if they were to just annex in, they would be assigned the CC zoning designation, but they would not automatically assume the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District designation. Mm-hmm. And you can see those are for the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay in the hierarchy of requirements. Is higher than the underlying zoning. So if you had an underlying R4 zoning, yet you were in the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District, you couldn't achieve those R4 lot sizes. You would be held to the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay 12,500 square feet. So it doesn't make any sense to request a district other than CC and then ask to be included in the overlay, because you're essentially still going to be held to that 12.5 requirement. So,
all right, committee, do you have any comments on this or a motion?
Are we only discussing the annexation?
I think we're discussing the annexation at this point by itself.
By itself, okay. No, I don't have questions about that.
All right, do we have a motion?
I'll move the move to approve the annexation request.
Second.
1246 Mile Road.
All right, do we have a second?
I second.
All right, any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right, motion carries unanimously. Item 4C is the rezoning to R4.
Okay. So currently in the county, it is zoned S3 Management District, which is commensurate with our comprehensive plan call for 3 units per acre. It is improved with 31 manufactured housing units, and the town's comp plan, as I said, does call for community conservation. The intent of that is to designate this area as a settlement community, but the plan also recommends the changing characteristics of this area. As you saw on the previous map, the 6 mile area is seeing, you've seen some changes over the years with properties, PDs going in, R4 zonings occurring, not being included in the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District. So those are all the things that you want to look at when you look at the proposed zoning. The R4 town zoning is intended for smaller lots, maximum development of the land. The adjacent zonings are R4, CC, and R1, as well as S3 in the county. There is that adjacent R4 zoning right here, and that is developed to 3.28 dwelling units per acre. It's 33 units on about 10 acres. So that kind of gives you an idea of what's going on in the surrounding area. As a matter of information, we have a green space preservation and protection plan. So anything over 5 acres is required, as Mr. Donato mentioned, to preserve 20% to 30% of green space. And that comes in the form of a buffer along the road, as well as internal areas. Those will all be reviewed and approved as part of the sketch plan process. And I think that's all I have, unless you have any questions.
I guess my question is why is the request, what does R3 versus R4 get, like, why is it the property size, lot sizes, is that why the request, because what's the units per acre for R3 versus R4 or R2?
R3 only allows duplexes, so okay. They're so, not, okay. You have R1, R2, and then R4.
Okay.
The applicant can speak more to the layouts and the conceptual plans, but presumably the R4 smaller lot size gives them more flexibility in retaining. There's some pretty large trees on those properties. There's that requirement for green space preservation. So the smaller lot size probably helps to give them more flexibility in retaining the larger trees and developing around that, as well as requiring the green space preservation areas, but...
The comprehensive plan calls for community conservation.
It does.
Okay. All right, do we have any motions?
Well, I'll make a motion to deny this request as presented to us, but I need a second before I can discuss it.
Is there a second?
I'll second that for discussion.
I'm the one responsible for holding this back for several meetings. Realizing that this is private property, and it's something that probably needs to be redeveloped, I still have compassion for the people who are living there today. I would really like to see the property owners do more than just retain a consultant to help them with their move. This is something which I guess is because time is moving on and they're under different circumstances. But denying this request would allow us to come back to make sure that not only is developed there part of saving all those trees. I mean, there's a lot of large oak trees on this site that are critical to be saved. Also to allow us to maybe make sure that it stays in the Sweetgrass Basket Overlay District. So that's the reason for my recommendation for denial.
All right. Any further discussion?
Just a question. Why can't we do that now? We have to wait for that just to give us more time. Is that what you're saying, Howard?
Well, I think it would have to be a separate motion. I'm not sure if Mr. Pagliarini's here.
I think the applicant would have to come to us with a rezoning request, right? Because if we deny the rezoning, then it automatically comes in as community conservation.
That's correct. The committee and then council could only decide on the application.
Correct. That's what I thought.
Okay.
And that's the reason I recommend a denial as it's currently before us.
Is that it?
So what fall into community conservation, what would that allow as far as development if they had to stay with that zoning?
So if they came in as community conservation, it
instead
allows single-family residential and larger lots. It's 12,500 square feet per lot as opposed to
4,000.
Yeah, 4,000 would fit how many lots on this?
4,000, they can accomplish, I think, 34. The density, there's no request to amend the comprehensive plan. So whether you get 12,500 square foot lots or 4,000 square foot lots, they're going to be limited to 3 units per acre. So really, the defining factor and what they can fit on there is based on the lot size. Can they accomplish 34 lots under 12.5? I doubt it, but I don't know. Perhaps they can. Either way, they're held to that maximum density. But the only difference is the lot size.
So we're talking about a difference between 30 and 34? Did I catch that right?
No.
Well,
the,
no.
The density for either zoning district is 3 times the acreage.
Which is 11.
So the total number of units is 3 times 12. Mm-hmm. So max under any zoning category would be 36.
36. Oh, sorry.
Right?
But maybe it is 36. They've been proposing 34, so I think that's the one I've been using. But
with community conservation, it requires a larger lot size,
correct.
A 12,500 versus a 4,000 square foot lot
size.
So
likely then you would not achieve the theoretical 3
right.
times 12.
Sorry.
It looks like they were, your understanding is that they were trying to save more trees by going with this, maybe? No?
All right. I don't want to speak to their intent.
I got you.
Yeah.
I can speak to that.
I think, do you want to hear from?
That'd be nice.
Yeah, go ahead, come forward.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'll be brief. I have a plan that's already been through DRT, which I'm happy to share with you.
Oh.
I don't know if that's possible or allowed.
Yes.
Yes, there are a tremendous amount of trees. If you happen to have a chance to drive through there, they're amazing. What is also amazing to see is some of these homes
are currently, when I say they're tucked up onto the base of some of these trees, I mean they're crammed up on some of these trees. So currently, this proposal does not remove any historic trees that are grade A. None. They all remain. There's only one live oak that is a B that we're asking for removal. The rest are either not historic, a failing grade, or of not a desirable species. So all of, one of the reasons why the 30% open space requirement, along with the R4, works so well is that it really helps us preserve some of the very large trees that are on this site. We feel like it really is a win for the town. Because, I mean, currently this is all private. There is no public open space on this site. So we feel like this is a big win. And I mean, and I know, you know, I maybe I'm stating the obvious, but the if you look at the map, the neighboring subdivision's road is stubbed out directly to this site. This was always meant to be renovated. The road is there. If you look down further on Spring Hope, the road is also stubbed back up. This is all meant to be connected at some point, just the way I see it. The neighboring subdivision would have never stubbed out a road if this wasn't meant to happen, which we are, of course, connecting to with our road and our sidewalks. And the other thing I just want to stress why I think this is a win for the town is it can just stay in the county. Mm-hmm. I mean, then what do we have? What do we get? I mean, as a town resident, what do we then have? We still have 31 homes. We still have the septic tanks. We still have zero open space to the public. I think this is, there's so much win here for the town. To me, I think this is a no-brainer. I've met with the Watts family. These are wonderful people. They really care about their residences. I mean, you're talking about a landlord that has residences on a month-to-month lease and gives them over 6 months' notice. Who does that? And who does that in this day and age? And has tried to help them find other places to live. They didn't have to do that.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, so when you spoke about having the landlord help the residents, because it is heartbreaking. I mean, I drive by it and want to start crying, but what were you thinking? Like, what kinds of things could they do?
Well, what I understand they've done is found places that are too expensive for most of the people to be able to move to. They've also provided somebody who's willing to buy their house, but then they won't have any place to live. Okay. So I'm looking for more cooperation back and forth to help these people who are in most cases, low income, mm-hmm. and need a step up. If something is done on this property, there's going to be a good bit of money made by the property owners. I think some of that should be shared in helping these people relocate.
Ms. Hyatt?
Well, he sat down. I'm just looking at the picture. I've been back there before. So you would be moving the road down the center of the property?
Yes, ma'am.
Right now it's divided. So instead of using an existing road, you would have to tear down trees in the center to make the road?
There are a couple of trees that we're asking to take out. One of them is a poor grade. One of them is not historic. And then if you can see, as we get back to the middle, we're veering the road off to the side to make certain we save, I believe it's a 31-inch live oak. And we've also, through the DRT process, I know we're showing a connection to the property to the north. We've also have been able to revise the plan to show a connection down to the neighbor to the bottom of the page. I know that's not the plan you're currently looking at, but that was something that came up through the DRT process, and it's something we can accomplish. So we can extend the connectivity that was extended to us. I might be hard to visualize, but as you can see, the neighbors above us extended a road, and we can do that to below us as well.
Ms. Hyatt, did you have anything?
Well, when you mentioned it, you're talking about this extension from the neighborhood next door.
Yes,
you would
ma'am.
You would adjoin that road?
Yes, ma'am. Currently, there's a big fence mm-hmm. blocking it.
There's the connection.
But does the town benefit from that, or would we be better to leave that space green than to cut a road through there. I mean, it's just moving you into a neighborhood that doesn't have connectivity. Is there an advantage to doing that for us?
Service provision, I mean, having subdivisions connected.
Activity.
You know, helps Mr. Peel's.
You know, it just goes over to another dead-end road. It doesn't, like, take you to a main.
Ultimately, over time, it incrementally occurs, and then it assists in terms of providing emergency response or other services.
For me, the issue is the comp plan and the fact that this is supposed to come in as community conservation. And with a 12,500 lot size, there would probably be fewer homes going into the property that would fit into the property. And I think that that's, you know, that's in line with where I feel like this council is headed, is that we're not going in the direction of higher density neighborhoods. It's we're more for the R1, the community conservation, that type of development within the town, and moving away from the higher density. So I'm going to vote in support of Mr. Chapman's motion. Do we have any further discussion?
If I could say one thing, I agree with you. I'm not saying you're wrong. I would say that the only difference here is there's currently 31 homes on the site. That would be my difference. I agree with you that that's where this area is in the overlay district, and that's what the area is meant to be, except for the fact that this is already developed with 31 homes on it.
All right, thank you. All right. The motion is to deny the rezoning. We have a second. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor of recommending to full council we deny? Aye. Say aye.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Okay. All right. Motion passes. Moving on to item 5 on the agenda, 5A, an annexation at Parker's Island Road.
So this is a petition to annex the property at 2841 Parker's Island Road. It is 3.95 acres. You can see it there. It's off of Highway 41, sort of across from where the entrances into Park West Dunes West would be, and then is across the creek from Rivertown. So the comprehensive plan does recommend community conservation for this area, as you can see, all of the yellow, and they will be given the automatic zoning designation of community conservation. And there you can see the zoning. So the property is outlined in green with a star, and you can see it's contiguous to the two adjacent properties that have already come in at CC.
Do we have a motion?
I'll move for approval, and then I want to say something.
Do you have a second?
Second.
Okay. We have a motion second. Mr. Chapman?
This appears to be in the Phillips community. So I'm glad to see that we've got some work going on. Phillips community hadn't turned us down completely now because of 41. Secondly, there is a development underway on Bent Oak, adjacent to it. Dan Ryan Builders is building right adjacent to it. All of the roads have been put in, sewers been, or storm drainage has put in, lots have been put together. Are we going to have this as part of that subdivision, or is there something we need to do to make sure that there is some connection? Because I believe Parker's Island Road dead ends right into a fence adjacent to this property.
Don't know what the layout of the adjacent subdivision is. We don't have that on a,
mm-mm.
Nor what the property owner's intent is. I think it was my understanding they were interested in dividing it and adding one more lot for family members, but not sure.
Right, Austin, yeah, did you have something to add? Sorry, Colin.
I spoke to the homeowner that's currently there on the lot.
Could you pull your mask down so we can understand you?
I spoke to the property owner dealing with the annexation, because this came through the normal route of MPW, contacted by them. They're looking to, the husband passed on. It's currently the wife that has it, the one house that's there. They're looking to split about, I think, into about three more parcels and give one to each son and daughter. And that's going to be...
So they're not going to go into this single-family residential area next to them?
No, no, they'd be completely separate, though they would have access through the right-of-way that dead ends at the property line.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, is there any further discussion?
No.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. Item number six, review of a planning commission recommendation, 6A.
Okay, this might look a little bit familiar. This came to you a few months ago, last year. It consists of eight parcels along Highway 17 between the Church at Life Park and sort of the Mellow Mushroom commercial area. It originally annexed in and was zoned AB, Area-Wide Business District. That request was consistent with the comp plan. They are now requesting to rezone all eight parcels to AB2. That request is also consistent with our comprehensive plan. If you'll recall, the original conceptual plan when they came in was to develop a racket tennis facility. And there was some speculation that it would not use up all of the acreage, so they were going to perhaps do some restaurants, hotel, maybe some supporting uses. Well, since that time, everything that's happened with COVID, they've ran into some problems, and they actually ended up settling on working with the FCA, Fiat Chrysler Association, that was originally going to go up at Tupelo, would now like to go on half of this parcel. So that requires an AB2 zoning and then a special exception through our Board of Zoning Appeals. And the eight parcels, they intend to, at one point, if the AB2 zoning gets approved, they would aggregate those, split it somewhere in the middle. They're not sure yet, and that's the reasoning for needing to rezone all eight parcels, because they're not sure exactly what their development plan is going to look like yet. In order to move forward with that site plan for the AB2 and the special exception, we need to have a very specific site plan associated with that. So the request is to go AB2 for all of it, aggregate all those parcels, put a subdivision line somewhere in the middle, and then the portion furthest north by the church would develop as the car dealership, and the portion to the south would continue to develop as the tennis facility. I have put in just the potential uses. As I said, the AB2, they would also have to get the special exception for the automobile dealership because you have outdoor display of vehicles. And because there can't be a condition on any of this rezoning, I just wanted to put in a comparison of some other uses that would be allowed. Most of them would also require conditional use, which is staff level, or a special exception, which again is Board of Zoning Appeals. But that just gives you an idea of the differences between AB and AB2. As an entire project, this does meet our impact assessment ordinance. It's considered a whole plan since we know all of the proposed uses. So irrespective of ownership or phasing, they would have to do a holistic development impact assessment. That would include looking at, including a master plan, incorporating all the land uses, access points, particularly to All American Boulevard, which is... there's a plan here where you can see it. So they would have to connect to All American Boulevard. They would have to work with our transportation department and our town engineer. There's been stormwater master planning for that whole area, so they have to make sure that they are in compliance to the drainage plan for the area, as well as the access management plan. And that would be the next step. So if the rezoning gets approved, they would have to come in and go to the Planning Commission. They would come back to y'all with an impact assessment. And once that got approved, the car dealership would then be able to go get a special exception from the Board of Zoning Appeals. Once that was approved, then they would go through the design review board process. And so this is kind of the first step.
Madam Chairman, I've heard enough. Process. I recommend denial.
Do we have a second? His motion is to deny. the rezoning.
And then we can discuss?
Yes, then we can discuss.
So I'll second that.
All right. We're in, okay, we are in discussion. We have a motion to deny, and we're in discussion. Mr. Chapman?
Well, first of all, I think with what's there, especially off of George Browder, a car dealership is not a good use. There's a huge church right behind here that is served by George Browder. There is Park West subdivision served by George Browder. I just think, you know, if they were going to do the racquetball, that's a different story. A large car dealership on this site that's not really easily accessible, left and right turns in and out of there, I just think it's a bad use.
Anyone else? I tend to agree with Mr. Chapman. I also think that rezoning to AB2, and because we cannot condition zoning, this is just what's on the table right now. Right. And rezoning to AB2 opens the door wide open to so many other uses that would not be positive for this piece of land. I think AB is expansive enough for this area, and I think, especially with all the steps and special exceptions and BOZA, I think that there's better usage for that land under AB. So I'm supporting Mr. Chapman's motion.
Now,
Ms. Hyatt?
Yeah. Did you mention that the lot that was planned at a different location was going to move to this site? Is that what you said? Tupelo area had one planned, which I know we had a lot of controversy about.
Right. There was a plan for the same car dealership to go up in Tupelo. And it went through all the approval process, but they ran into an issue with the with wetlands, and they weren't able to move forward. And so they worked out something on this spot, and they'd like to move forward here now.
And it was, and on this plat, where it, was it going on 17?
It's going to be
towards
half
the front,
half of this property.
Yeah. So the reason all eight parcels are included in the rezoning is because they don't know AB2 is not required for the racket facility. However, they don't know where this line's going to go, and those lot lines need to be established before it can move forward. So, I think their intent is to perhaps subdivide somewhere down the middle here, and this area right here would be the car dealership. And then this area down here would continue to develop as the racket facility. They would have to get encroachment permits if they were to come off Highway 17. That would be through DOT, and they would have to work with the town transportation department to have access off of All American Boulevard, which does come off of George Browder and runs through here, and then connects down like that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Corley, do you have any thoughts?
No, I see that, you know, that close access to Park West and the church is, you're right, not the right fit for a car dealership.
Is no further discussion? All in favor of the motion to deny the rezoning, please say aye.
Aye.
All right, motion passes. Item B, rezoning the Gregory Ferry Landing. This was the affordable housing development, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Move for approval.
Motion to approve. Thank you.
We have a motion to approve. Do we have a second?
Second.
Second. Okay, we have a motion to approve a second. Is there any discussion? No discussion. All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Moving on to item C, proposal to amend Chapter 156 about non-conforming lots.
Yes, this is a proposed text change. And at this point, it will save you some time. Staff would ask, we would like to withdraw that request. It's part of a larger effort to look at nonconformities. We tried to move it forward quickly at the request of the Planning Commission. And then when they met last week, they had more changes and things that they wanted to look at. So then they said, well, why don't we wait and put it all together. So we, as a staff, it's town initiated. We would just withdraw it, and you'll see this component when the full set of nonconformity provisions comes forward.
Okay, are we comfortable with that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, all right. Moving on to item 7, amendments to the flood damage prevention ordinance.
And Mr. Rob Rogerson of our staff will present this. Rob is our floodplain manager and the most informed of at least us in terms of dealing with the flood damage prevention ordinance. Good afternoon.
All right, so as most of you are probably aware, the flood maps for Charleston County have been under development, new maps for since 2006. And they finally were approved by FEMA recently. FEMA issued a letter to the town and other jurisdictions in Charleston County about the date in which those maps will become effective, which is January 29th, 2021. For the town to remain as a participant in the National Flood Insurance Program, we have to adopt those maps by ordinance. And so that's what this first, under required revisions, this first item is concerning the adoption of those maps by ordinance.
Okay. All right, do we have a motion?
You can do it. We've got a number of changes.
Oh, okay. All right,
so
sorry.
We can go through it all and then you can decide if you need to split anything out.
Yeah, the first three are basically mandatory if we want to remain in the National Flood Insurance Program. So I'll just run through the second one quickly is adding a severability clause to our ordinance, which we haven't had in there. And that is something that they want us to have in the ordinance. I believe David's good with that. A pretty standard clause. The third item is a little more complex. It concerns residential accessory structures. And we have in our ordinance this section 152.22E, which enables us to exempt residential accessory structures from having to meet the elevation requirements of buildings in the special flood hazard area. In other words, if you've had a garage you wanted to build and the base flood elevation is 12 feet and your ground elevation is 8 feet, you would have a problem trying to elevate your garage. FEMA gave us allows us to automatically exempt certain structures and residential accessory structures that are what we call wet flood proofed, which allows basically water to come in and go out of the structure. It's meant for garages and limited storage. So we have not had a square footage as part of that ordinance. They want us to add something to limit the size. We're suggesting 750 square feet because that's basically the maximum accessory structure size allowed in our zoning ordinances for these type of structures. Mm-hmm. They may come back and say it needs to be less. We're trying to negotiate that with them now, but right now the proposal is for 750 square feet.
Yeah.
All right, under recommended revisions, so with the new flood maps coming in, we see this as a good opportunity to revise a few things on our ordinance. The new flood maps create a new flood zone. It's called the Coastal A Zone. That has not been an area defined previously on our flood maps. It's basically an area between an AE zone and a VE zone. And the difference between an AE zone and a VE zone is the wave height during what we call a base flood event. So if the wave height is believed to be 3 feet or greater, it's called a VE zone. If it's less than that, previously it was just an AE zone. FEMA has recognized over our unfortunate experience in recent years with storms and damage that a wave of 1.5 to 3 feet can do significant damage. So they've started to map these so-called coastal AE zones. So these first two items under definitions basically define the AE zone and also this what we call the limit of moderate wave action line that is the boundary of that zone. So that is the purpose of these two definitions. Now, the next item is the more controversial, I'd say. Right now, our flood ordinance has a what we call freeboard 1 foot. That's an addition to the base flood elevation and an elevation that you have to elevate a structure to in a high-risk flood zone. So our proposal is to go to 2 feet. Several reasons for that. Of course, there's a lot of discussion about resiliency now. Unfortunately, these maps, do not really take into account sea level rise or increase in intensity of storms and that type of thing. So resiliency is a big part of this. Another benefit is that we get a good number of points in the community rating system program, which helps lower insurance rates for our town residents for flood insurance policies. Also, it would be consistent. Charleston County and the city of Charleston have both gone to a 2 foot freeboard versus 1 foot freeboards. The flood maps, we're seeing this as a good opportunity. A lot of properties have actually been removed from the special flood hazard area when these maps become effective. Statistically, FEMA broke it out for us, 485 parcels are being added to the special flood hazard area with these maps, but 3,174 parcels are being removed from the special flood hazard area. There are a lot of areas where the base flood elevation is actually decreasing 1 to 2 feet in the new maps. There will be some houses that, existing houses that will be impacted. They will no longer be, they'll be non-conforming to the new ordinance if we add 1 foot freeboard to it. And that's always, whenever you do something like this, you're going to create that situation. I don't know if anyone has any questions on it. The next item, basically we're redefining slightly how what we consider an elevated building versus a crawl space building. And this is due to a change in the community rating system program definitions. They basically changed it from 5 feet to 4 feet. So that's what I'm proposing we do for our definitions also. Next item is our substantial improvement clause in our ordinance. Currently, we have a 10-year cumulative in that clause. We track improvements to a building or damages to a building over a 10-year period. If they ever reach that 50% threshold or exceed it, then they're considered either substantially damaged or substantially improved, and they would have to be brought into conformity with the town's requirements. That's currently 10 years. I'm proposing changing it to 5 years, actually reducing it a little bit, which would be, again, consistent with Charleston County and the City of Charleston's requirements. Next item has to do with construction on fill material. We already have this section on our ordinance. These changes are basically to clarify some of those requirements and more closely match those found in the state's model flood ordinance for use of fill. The next item concerns elevated structures and the allowed area that we allow to be enclosed. We currently limit under elevated structures where the ground floor level is below the design flood elevation enclosures to no more than 200 square feet. I'm just increasing that, proposing increasing that to 299 square feet, which allow a little more enclosed area under these elevated houses. And it's also allowed in the community rating system program up to 299 feet enclosed. And then I am trying to clarify some language about what we call louvered panels around perimeter structures. I'm just trying to clean up the language a little bit. The last section is to add the coastal A zone basically to our ordinance. As we discussed, the new flood maps delineate this new flood zone. The state mandated building codes already require that houses, when you have a coastal A zone identified on your flood maps, you have to regulate them to the same requirements as a V zone. The purpose of this section is basically to add that to our ordinance to require that buildings in coastal A zones be regulated the same as the VE zones. And that's it.
All right. Do we have a motion?
Move for approval.
Second?
Second.
Motion and a second. We are in discussion. Does the committee have any questions?
No, ma'am.
Do you have any questions? I have a question about the move to 2 feet.
Yes.
For the, what's it called? The free?
Freeboard.
Freeboard. You stated this would create some non-conforming properties. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so then they would be impacted by the 50% improvement rule.
If they were doing substantial improvements or substantial damage, yes.
Okay, so just add some properties to that. Okay.
Correct.
All right, thanks. We have a motion to approve and a second. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, motion carries. Item number 8 is issues regarding short-term rentals.
Ms. Reed is going to take this one this afternoon.
Oh, I thought Rob was doing it.
She wished.
That's not true, Mr. Chapman. I'm thrilled to be here. Okay. Just a quick recap of September. We talked about the beginning of the program. Of course, many of you were here during that process. It did begin in January of this year. We talked about the permit process, how that's going. We gave you some of the numbers. We gave you locations, some maps of where those are, and then we talked about permit enforcement and complaint enforcement. And then we talked about the administration of it, and then some issues and lessons learned, and some things that came out of that discussion, both from this committee and from staff, which we'll touch on in just a little bit. But the three primary things that, as Jeff mentioned this morning in the committee meeting, that we got out of the meeting was inadequate parking, the total number, which we currently have the cap, and then we talked about distribution or spacing, and then stricter enforcement. So we're just going to touch on all of those and give you a little bit of what we currently have, what we could do, and what would that look like, what would that mean, and some of the unintended consequences of those. So the first one, inadequate parking, we currently, if somebody wants to come in and build a single family residence, they're only required to provide one off-street parking space. Now, many of them fit two, but that's what we have. It's one off-street parking space. If you want to do a townhouse development, you're required to have two spaces, and then multifamily is 1.5 to 3. Obviously, most would choose two. They're not going to choose three. If you have a short-term rental in a single-family residence, you are already required to have one space because you have a residence, and then you're required to have an additional one, so that's two spaces. If you have a townhouse, we have a lot of STRs and townhouses, you already have two spaces, you have to do one additional, that's three. That's what we have now. So I believe this came up, correct me if I'm wrong, there were complaints of off-street parking. Some issues with that are that we could require additional parking spaces. That would mean a complete overhaul of other sections of our ordinance. We have a section in our ordinance for, it's our parking schedule, it's our off-street parking requirements and loading requirements. We'd have to change what's required for a single-family residence, because to require more than what's allowed just to have a residence would mean a lot of non-conforming homes out there. And it would mean a lot more ordinance changes. But that doesn't make it impossible. It's just something that we would have to think about moving forward if that was one of the solutions. Also, having an additional off-street parking space doesn't necessarily mean somebody can't park on the street. If I have a single-family house that I'm not renting out, I have an off-street parking space, but I can still park on the street. So that more comes into what's allowed as far as on-street parking. It becomes more of a police issue, and if it is a police issue, I don't know how we deal with that. But we just kind of wanted to give you the scenario of if you provide more off-street parking, there are some other issues as well. And Jeff mentioned this morning, so say we have more pavement in our yards, and that affects trees, it affects stormwater runoff. So those are some things that we want to think about when we're adding more impervious surface for driveways. So next was the total number and distribution. As you'll recall, we went through a lot of different scenarios when this ordinance was being prepared. And I remember doing a lot of research and getting some help from the, I think it was the Charleston Association of Builders, or something like that. He was offering up these declustering ordinances, and he sent me, of course, it all kept coming back to Durango, Colorado. And several communities in Colorado have these spacing requirements or these declustering ordinances, and we looked at those, and they were pretty cumbersome. I know Durango is the one that has the declustering ordinance. They limit one per street and per intersection, per block and per intersection. They're a town of 8,000 homes and 15,000 people, and they have a much larger staff than we do. So I think those are some things. In fact, I was following up on it for this PowerPoint, and I saw that they won the award for the worst home sharing regulations in the state of Colorado. So I don't think the entire state was very fond of those regulations, and they've proven to not be very effective, and they've had some issues with those. What happened, though, with that 1% cap was that we have neighborhoods that that have covenants and restrictions that prohibit home sharing and short-term rentals. And so if you'll recall that location, those location maps, we have a concentration of them in older Mount Pleasant. And I think that was kind of known going in. This is what we would end up with. But we can tell you that there are some ways that we could further limit short-term rentals. It may be, to limit the number of short-term rentals one person or one entity or management company has. Many of them only have one. We have some with two, three, four. We have one with seven or eight right now. One person administers the program, so we need to think about putting more things in place. Not only are we creating more nonconformities, but is it something that we can enforce? For those that never got a permit and are sort of were to that enforcement stage, and we're trying to follow up and follow through with enforcement, they're starting to kind of thumb our nose at us, and are you going to come after us? And we are, and Jane's doing a great job of sending out the letters and following up, and most of these have gotten up to two and three letters already, and we're getting ready to follow through with tickets. But we just want to make sure as we move forward that we're creating regulations that we can administer as a staff. And so we just want to keep that in mind. But we think one way we might be able to do that is we haven't met the cap yet. We're at 324 permits right now. Our cap is probably 400 to 410, something in that range. We could lower the cap. That might be one way. We could look at whole house rentals versus renting on site, with the property owners on site. We do think there would be some issues with that, because what's already permitted and approved is out there, and they're going to continue. So anything we institute or change in this ordinance is going to create further nonconformities. And so that's something we want to think about moving forward. And there's a lot of good faith out there, too. People have become familiar with our ordinance requirements, and they are in the process of purchasing homes. They're in the process of selling their homes and saying, hey, you can have a short-term rental here. And so we know there's a lot of that out there where, if we go and change these regulations midstream, just being aware of the consequences of that and how it affects people. But we do think there are some ways that it could be limited, especially since we haven't met our cap yet. So let's see, it's total number and distribution, stricter enforcement. I think this is one of those issues where there's much ado about nothing. I mean, from staff's perspective, we don't really have a huge violation issue, and we don't really have an enforcement issue. We're rocking and rolling pretty good. Of our 324 permits, we have about 222 that are whole house rentals, so the property owner does not live on site. For those whole house rentals, the town has had 33 complaints, and 16 are along one street. And if you'll recall, I know one of the biggest issues with enforcement was somebody was waiting to get their permits, and they were operating. So as Jeff said this morning, on day one, everybody was non-compliant. We had to give folks a chance to understand the ordinance, know about it, come into compliance. You still have folks that aren't complying with that. And so the one enforcement issue that we did have on Vincent was it was somebody in the process. They had applied for their permit, and the neighbors were complaining that they were operating without a permit. Once they got their permit, we've gotten zero complaints. The complaints on Vincent are mostly just seem to be they seem to be things where the police will get called out, and it's very benign. It's really not even an issue. So for us as staff, when we talk about issuing a violation letter and following through with enforcement, we have to try to figure out, is this really a complaint, or is this the neighbor just not wanting the use there? And if you've got somebody that has the proper permits, they're following all the rules, like the lady that stood up this morning at the committee meeting, she's done everything she's supposed to be, and nothing she does will make her neighbor happy because they don't want the STR there. And so for staff, it's trying to figure out, is this truly an issue? Is this really something that the police got called out for because it's a party, or was somebody sitting outside with their music and talking and the neighbors didn't like it? So more than anything, we're doing a lot of babysitting and hand-holding. And when I say we, I mean more Jane, because she's getting the brunt of it. But we feel like our enforcement is really pretty good. We've made contact with everybody that was operating without a permit. Many of those have come into compliance. The ones that aren't, we're following through. We're getting ready to write, I think, 10 tickets for folks that just continue to not get their permits. So it's really working pretty well. But we are open to any suggestions that y'all may have. I know that we as staff, just operating and administering that for almost a year now, we know about some things that need to be changed, just some little things that would certainly make this easier to administer from our perspective. One we talked about is the commercial versus business. Even though this requires a business license, it's not a business. If I have a house and I live in it, and then I rent it out and somebody else comes there and lives in it for 3 days, they're still living in it. It's still a residence. I'm not coming in and opening up a restaurant. That's a business. So, and our zoning administrator has weighed in on this, and we went back and forth. And so what we need to do is just make it crystal clear in the ordinance that just because you have to have a business license doesn't mean it's a commercial activity. It's still a residential use of a residential property on residential zoning. And so a lot of our neighborhood covenants and restrictions didn't contemplate this type of use. When it says no business activity, short-term rentals weren't even around. But we are certainly recognizing those, and we're in constant communication with HOAs. Some of them are revising their covenants and restrictions to explicitly prohibit short-term rentals, and some of them say, you know what, we've backed off, we're fine with it. So we're definitely working with them. And so just a few of the things we want to change are the proof of requirement for taxes. We feel like there's a better way to do that instead of Jane chasing all these people down and sending them to Charleston County. The definition of violations, we want to remove the trash cans and add disturbance of peace with noise, because the noise ordinance applies 9 p.m. to 7 a.m., but in the middle of the day, like we talked about earlier, you could have a disturbance of the peace, so we wanted to add that language in. And then we also wanted to change some of the submittal requirements of what you're required. So these are just things that, regardless of what direction you all send us in for changes, we'd like to come back with these changes anyway. We just feel like they would help us administer this program a little bit better. But I think other than it being a little overwhelming, just because it's the first year and we're trying to implement it and get it going, I think it's went pretty well. and I really don't think we have any major problems or violation issues. And if we do, we're working on them. And I think it's brought in, you know, some revenue for the town. We've been able to go after people. We're starting to issue fines. And if you'll recall, it's a $250 application fee for each of these. So, you know, I think it's been a good thing. And most folks are respectful of it, and they do the right thing. And so we're happy to answer any questions that you have.
Does anyone else have questions? I have questions.
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Chapman? Yeah. Why do you have to issue three letters before you can fine them?
That's just, so we have two types of enforcement. You have somebody who is operating a short-term rental and never got a permit. That's just a basic violation of our zoning code. And you're subject to general, I think it's general penalties, section 1099. What that means is, and if you go and look at that section, there's not really a procedure for enforcement. So over the years, our code enforcement officers have come up with a procedure. And how that typically works is you send a letter, you give them a certain amount of time to come into compliance, you send a second letter. And I think what he does is, the third letter is actually not a letter, it's a fine or a ticket. What we have done, because we know this is a new program, we're trying to be, you know, somewhat understanding, what we have done is, these are for folks not violating their permit, but never getting a permit. What we do is send one letter, we give them a certain amount of time to come into compliance, we send a second letter, and then the third letter is through certified mail, because you gotta, this is very time consuming for staff, because many of these people don't live on the property. And then they've sold.
That's the problem.
It's difficult often to find the property owner, to find where they live, to track them down, to make sure that they got the letter. So so there's a lot of follow-up, a lot of research, a lot of cross-checking. But that's what we do, just the third letter, and then we're now at the point where we've issued that third certified letter, and we're going to start issuing fines.
Is it Charleston County or the city of Charleston that requires the property owner to be in the residence when they're renting a bedroom?
City. I think city.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
I think city of Charleston.
Yes. Okay.
But they have different zones and different sections for historic, so I don't know that it applies across the board, but it certainly is one of their regulations.
Well, it surely makes an issue, makes it easier to try to get something done.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone else have any?
I'd be interested in exploring that, lowering it from 1 to 0.75, I think
0.75 would take us, I've been doing the math as we've been sitting here, I think 0.75 would take us to 300, and we already issued 324 permits. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that we could lower it to 0.75, and then just if people choose not to renew, like if they're grandfathered in, they're grandfathered in, but if they choose not to renew or the property changes hands, then it drops off and it lowers the number of STRs.
I'd feel better about that, just because I am worried about people that are supplementing their income by doing this. You know, there's the other side of that. And as they were explaining also, when you're talking about numbers, like 33 complaints, 16 on the same street, when we've got over 300 rentals, mm-hmm. that's pretty good mm-hmm. percentage-wise. Because I'm just not looking forward to creating a big problem. Is there a big problem overall?
Yeah, I think lowering the cap would be something that I would support, because what we've seen is what we expected to see, which is a concentration of STRs in Old Mount Pleasant. And we've also weren't sure quite how many people are out there. And so this ordinance has been in place since the beginning of the year. There has been plenty of time and plenty of publicity and plenty of notification that anyone who wants to be compliant and mm-hmm. operate as a good faith Airbnb, you know, short-term rental person has done so. And what's remaining, I think we've been lenient enough with giving people time to comply. So I would support lowering the cap. I don't think there's much we can do about the parking. The one thing I'm wondering, and one of the complaints that I've received from multiple citizens is, the party house type of thing, or like the wedding party where there are suddenly 30 cars on the street mm-hmm. For the event or for whatever it is happening at the property. Is there any way for us to regulate that? Is that a violation of any other town ordinance or?
It's a violation of the STR ordinance. Well, I think with regards to overnight, I'd have to look again and see. I don't know. I mean, if I live there and I have 30 people visiting me because we're getting ready to go to a wedding, I don't know how you would differentiate that between a rental. But that's something we could certainly look into when we come back.
Yeah, I think I'd be curious to know if there's anything we can do, because I think that's been an issue for right. for neighbors as well as the party house type of thing.
Right.
And I think that's something that, you know, different Airbnb owners often have restrictions in their agreements with people about what is allowed to be right. done on the property. So I don't know if that's more something we should encourage mm-hmm. The property owners to do versus something that should be in the ordinance. But I think that reducing the cap is probably an important step to take. I don't think that we should change it to only homeowners, because there are too many people that have, I mean, the majority of our short-term rentals are people who don't live on the property. And I think there doesn't seem to be huge numbers of complaints. But I do think, as far as enforcement goes, the having not stricter enforcement in the sense of like that you're not enforcing it, but that if there is a real violation, mm-hmm. how that is calculated over the time frame and how that and what results in a revocation of the permit. Mm-hmm. I think that it's important that if there's repeat offenders, the permit should be revoked. I also think that if someone is you know, when should this grace period end? Mm-hmm. If you're operating an unpermitted short-term rental, at what point do we say, no, you don't get to come in and get a permit anymore? You know, it's too late and we're not offering that grace to you anymore. Mm-hmm. The time period is over. So I think a combination of lowering the cap and maybe saying as of January 1, 2021, mm-hmm. if you're not in compliance and you're running an illegal one, you're denied a permit, even if there's any available.
Okay.
That's kind of my... because that would prevent bad actors.
I like it. I think
that provision, we discussed that at police legal this morning for those committee mm-hmm. members not there. And the general discussion was a year penalty mm-hmm. In that circumstance if you have not applied for a permit. So just for the
yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think the other side of that is just what's bothering me a little bit is just tying people's hands who might be in this times wanting to just get some income going. And that's where I'm having a hard time with this. You know, I'm, mm-hmm. in my head, I want to help our residents if they're in dire times to do whatever they have to do to pay their bills and pay their mortgage. But I hear what you're saying.
If I may, and I agree with you, if it helps you make the decision anymore, every person that has come through our software that is operating an STR without a permit has been notified at least a couple times. So we have, Jane has worked really hard to notify folks who are operating without a permit. We've got the information out, we've got the websites out. I think we're getting to a point where the people that aren't getting a permit just are not going to get a permit.
Exactly.
And it really seems like the folks who have come in and want to do the right thing, they're permitted and they're operating. And those are the people we're kind of dealing with now. They're the ones that just, they don't care and they're going to continue to operate. And that's why we're to the point of issuing fines.
Yes.
Gotcha. And so we're finding.
We could also limit instead of dropping the cap to 0.75, which would take it to 300, we could drop it to 0.85, mm-hmm. which would take it to 340. So that would still leave, you know, 16 more permits available, so that if there are people who are in the process or whatever, that there's still an opportunity for them to come in. But then would also not cram 76 more, you know, like short-term rentals and waterway arms. So does that seem like a good mm-hmm. thing from the committee? Well, so 0.85?
I like the 0.75.
You like the 0.75? You want to? Well, we already have more than 0.75 issued. We have 324 right. issued.
But I think we're getting ready to have some.
If you want to, you remember, this is re-evaluated at January of every year, because the more dwelling units we have, this goes up. So if you want a set number, I would say 350. 350 instead of a percentage of the total dwelling units,
because
you need to keep in mind that if there is another surge, the allowable 0.75%, that 340, that's going to go up. That's not a set number. That's a percentage of the total dwelling
units. So maybe move to 340 or 350?
Or 350 if it's a set number.
I'd be down for 350.
350?
What I was going to say is I have less of a problem of the number that we're allowing as the way they're so concentrated. I would feel better if we could find a way that we could disperse them.
Well, I think we spent a long time trying to figure that out,
but I mean, that would seems to be what would solve the problem more than limiting.
Yeah, but they're all grandfathered in. They're all existing now. So as long as they stay in compliance, all of those can continue.
I think
that's
the only problem. I think
too.
Because of the nature of the development of Mount Pleasant and with the HOAs that have restrictions, I think that we have to put a number have a cap on it. And I think 350 sounds like a good number that we could change to, that would still give a little bit of wiggle room for those last few stragglers that maybe still have a legitimate reason for not complying with our ordinance. But I think, and then that would also limit that concentration inherently. And I agree with you, because as the number of dwelling units increases in this town, you know, we just talked about annexing properties in and more dwelling units coming in, it's just going to keep going up.
Mm-hmm.
So we're probably talking about the people that are going to come in right now are people that are doing it. It's not like we're going to have new people that are thinking about doing it. These are people that are doing it that we're going to finally get to comply. And we have how many?
324
permitted.
324. So that gives... That's a nice number, 350. I like it.
Okay.
And we can update you on that because it will take time for an ordinance amendment to institute a number. So if Jane's successful in getting more people to come in, we'll let you know where we are in relation to a hard and fast number so that you can look at it. Because this needs to go through public hearing, planning commission,
right,
back to council. So there'll be a time lag there where some more activity could occur.
I think you just answered a question I wanted to know. When is it going to Planning Commission?
It could go next month, right?
So October 21st is our next meeting. It wouldn't meet that. After that, we have December 16th, so it can go for public hearing December 16th, come to y'all in January, and go for first reading in January.
Okay, so we've got a time frame. And then when Jane does reach out to people, she can also let them know that this is coming down the pipeline.
Right, sure.
All right. Okay, does that sound good? Do you feel like you have enough information from us to
absolutely
move forward? All right, thank you so much. Moving on from item 8, short-term rentals, to item 9, informational report, design review board, building height measurement. This is an issue that I've raised before, where we have talked about limiting, we've lowered the building heights, we have a limit in feet, but to allow for some architectural diversity, we've also talked about having a story requirement as well. So we had asked Design Review Board to take a look at this. So Mr. Alma?
Yes, thank you. You asked them to do that before COVID, but they finally had an opportunity to look at it, and staff presented the topic, and this is just sort of the observations that we received from the Design Review Board. And remember, they're mostly professionals in the design architecture side of things. Establishing building heights by feet does affect the quality of design. And so if you say so many feet, if I'm going to squeeze in another floor and I'm creating, say, something like 8-foot floors, that the kinds of spaces that you get in there are not necessarily the most comfortable. They suggest also thinking about taller first floors, and said, you know, create a minimum height for a first story. And I guess our sort of the punchline here at the end is, we as a staff don't see any way that you could only regulate buildings by stories. You're always running into the question of, like this one, create a minimum height for a first floor. Well, if you're only using stories, people automatically going to say, well, how tall is that first story? So it's really going to be a combination of stories and some measurement in feet, unless we go metric, but that's what we would use. Obviously, more dynamic design is preferred, They did suggest maybe that if you looked at something where folks would, as with taller buildings, might include more functional open space, either natural or plazas and courtyards and those kinds of things, kind of creating an incentive-based system, but that would take a little while to look at. Combination minimum height for the first with a maximum height for each additional story. Again, this trips you up on the measuring in feet. They had a general question, why have a height limit and why are our buildings so low? That's a policy decision, not one. They just review whatever that comes to them. And they did make a comment that along Johnny Dodds, because of the scale of the street, so you've got the, you know, the main line and then you have the frontage roads, the scale of buildings could be taller along something like that as opposed to a narrower street. And so, again, we don't think we can measure it only in stories. We are in the midst and are getting ready to start our zoning code update. And so what we would recommend is that we continue to keep this in mind and try where we can to incorporate using stories. But we just want you to know to recognize that you're still going to need some kind of measurement, you know, dimensional measurement in order to make all of this work. The other thing, if there's an issue with how buildings look, regulating height by whatever mechanism is really, again, not a direct way to get at it. Design guidelines, architectural standards, and other kinds of the things are the avenue we ought to be pursuing rather than a back doorway to try to get at, let's get better looking buildings by going in this route. We could get better looking buildings by defining what those are and saying, this is what we want in our community. That's a whole nother project and an update of the design standards. But we'll be looking at those in the zoning code update because those are in the DRB overlay. So we'll get a chance to look at that.
Committee, do you have any thoughts? One of the things that comes into mind for me is with the height limitations, to have an allowance for a varying roof line, if it's a non-functional space, if it's not a habitable space, that they could have a sloped roof or they could have something that's a little bit different and have that not count towards the ultimate height because that would allow for some architectural diversity. So I think if that could be something that is factored in as well.
Quicker.
That would be helpful. But I think we, you know, to answer the question, why so low, why is the height limits are so low? I always point to Kauai. Kauai is a beautiful island and they have an ordinance there that no building is taller than a palm tree. And it's to preserve the sites of the beach, the sites of the water and that kind of thing. And I think that we, as a waterfronting town, have a similar thing going on where we want to preserve views of the water. We want to preserve the suburban feel of the town. We are not, for me, I can't speak for the full council. I feel like I was not elected to help with the urbanization of Mount Pleasant at all. I think that, you know, nobody's asking Sullivan's to urbanize. Nobody's asking Isle of Palms to urbanize. I don't see why Mount Pleasant should be the one to bear that and to add really tall buildings close to the street and create a narrowed skyline. So I think that's where I come from. I don't know if other members of the committee want to speak to that, but that's where I come from when speaking about why we lowered the heights.
I agree.
Okay. Ms. Corley?
I'm just, what you're saying, just to translate, what you're saying is that you don't feel comfortable using the word stories, that staff would like to add feet. And is there not a way that we can add feet and stories?
Yeah.
Can
yes, and that's what we would look at as we update the zoning code. We wouldn't rush into it at this point and try to institute, let's suddenly switch to just measuring in stories. We would use the avenue that's available to us right now in rewriting the code to look at that as we move forward.
Because you know what we're saying, right?
Sure.
I mean, we've been saying it for, I think that we're not veering. I think we're all in this together. So what would happen next?
So I think the next step is this, when we're doing the zoning ordinance update, which
you can expect recommendations that would relate to use of stories more than we might do in combination with feet.
Okay.
And so you know, we would keep that in mind as we go forward.
Okay. So this is basically.
So you don't need to take it at this point, if you agree with that, no action that you would take on this.
All right, is there any further discussion from council on this? All right, moving on from item number 9 to item 10, discussion of the redevelopment center recommendations within the draft comprehensive plan. Mr. Alma?
Thank you. So in recent discussions, this topic was sent back for further discussion, and one of the things that we've heard is maybe needing introductory language in the comp plan that would sort of better define what the overall vision is. So we've taken a stab at that with sort of an overarching vision statement, where section 2.1 in the plan talks about the vision, and it sort of skips over this topic, and it really focuses in on sort of the other aspects of that the plan covers. So if there is a desire to explicitly express the fact that, you know, a more suburban environment is what we're looking for, we've added this extra language in here that maybe is suitable or appropriate for incorporating in the plan. And in the actual vision statement itself, which follows, you would have language that looks like this, where the town would be sustainable, resilient, and a high quality suburban community, which continues to reflect and embrace the small town roots. So it's kind of trying to put in words that sentiment maybe better than we had it before.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one piece. And then that is supported by a lot of other things in the plan. So, you know, we've got information that says that's a legitimate statement. It's almost like we didn't say it straight up, but it's there in the message. And, you know, the land use section of the plan talks a lot about the history, the size of the community, predominantly suburban. So there's a basis for being able to put that language in there. The big one that we've continued to struggle with are the redevelopment centers and whether or not and to what degree you would have residential uses. We've thought about this a little bit more. We've also heard there's a question about whether or not town center, that designated redevelopment area, should be included. And so what you could consider are a couple of options. One, in both options, just don't designate town center as a redevelopment center at this point. It would be a commercial designation. And then for the two remaining, so this would be the Wando Crossing general area at 526 and the Houston Northcutt Center. Add general language in this section that would specify this preference for non-residential. We really would prefer to see non-residential development occur as these areas redevelop. However, some residential could be allowed, and the way we've structured it is more on a case-by-case basis, where the council's in the driver's seat to be able to review a request and a proposal. So that general language would read something like this. We would continue to use permit allocation and other measures, and the primary focus is enhancing commercial and economic development opportunities. And so the residential becomes the ancillary. And what we would require then, instead of setting a number or a density or anything, it would be that in order to consider that some residential, a property owner would have to submit a PD rezoning, plan development district zoning, and then that has to go through the whole process. And when that comes in front of you as a council, you have that opportunity to decide, is this suitable? Is this appropriate? Is it too much? Is it not enough? And just decide that way, rather than establishing a number in advance. So you wouldn't specify or predetermine it, and that you would only have mixed-use plan developments, and you probably would have an impact assessment that would accompany that anyway, so you could start to get a feel for the impacts. And then in any case, we've stressed this before, the existing zoning allows things that do not correspond with what it is you're saying today. So existing zoning needs to be fixed and changed pronto in order to preclude the residential development that's already allowed under today's existing zoning in these areas. And then option two, you could continue to go in the route that we were going in, where you might set a numerical cap and then do everything else that's suggested here. And we even went in and discounted for the land area that's in streets and roads and interstate interchanges, et cetera. So it reduced the actual developable acreage that you would multiply some number against. We would still include this preference for non-residential uses. And then you could say two units to the acre times the acreage, and you have a number to start with as a target, and then you still consider each individual PD rezoning case by case. And so if you use two times our new acreage, you would get 350 units for this center and 554 for I-526, which would be a grand total of 904. And currently we have 464 between located in those two locations. If you drop that to one, then you see the numbers here, 175 plus 277, that would give you 452 grand total, and we have 464 now in the two. And again, PDs, and you need to make zoning changes in order to effectuate this change in policy, because current zoning contradicts and conflicts with this new direction. And then there are a lot of other pieces in the plan, again, that talk about this. And then there was one other area that Ms. Hyatt raised in a piece of the plan. It's new. We can go through that now, or if you want to talk about the other two first.
Why don't we talk about the other two first?
Okay.
The redevelopment center.
So that ends where we are on those.
Could you go back one slide, one more slide? There we go, right there. All right. Committee, any discussion or any thoughts on this?
Well, I had questions about, you were saying it would be defined as a PD, these two areas, and then we need to get, or no, and then?
No, the areas would still be designated redevelopment center. Anybody mm-hmm. proposing to incorporate residential in a new redeveloped project would have to submit a PD rezoning to okay. the town. And that would have to go through the entire process, which would include public hearings, review by planning commission, and review by council. So in effect, it's a case by case. You decide at the time whether you think this development proposal fits or doesn't fit.
And then with the residential cap, that would be sort of a pool of residences that the PD could then apply for within, and it would be a redevelopment first come, first serve basis.
Yeah, and it'd be kind of a guide. So you'd say, well, we're expecting about this many. Some of the units were removed in one redevelopment project. This person is asking for a part of what might have been left. And it kind of gets maybe at the net idea that you all have discussed, but it's not predetermined. You don't apply it parcel by parcel. It's just like a lot of our other ordinances, building permit allocation, short-term rentals. It's a first come, first serve, and you judge it at the time. I mean, this plan is intended to last 10 years. So out in year eight, environment could be different, and you'd say, no, this still doesn't make sense to us, or yes, it does.
I like option two with C at the bottom. That's close to what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
I am not sure about what things are going to be zoned, but you said we're going to have to hurry and write that in these areas, what the underlying zoning is will be.
Right. And so what happens today is under today's overlay, the opportunity for residential already exists.
Right.
We would need to move forward mm-hmm. and remove that provision that allows mm-hmm. residential by right, because people don't have to rezone. They just come in with a plan and it says, your zoning allows me to do X, I'm doing X. You want something less than X, so we need to go fix that component. I don't believe it would mean wiping out the entire overlay, because the overlay deals with what you want to see with non-residential development.
Right.
But it might just be the residential aspect of the boulevard overlay only in these two couple hundred acre areas.
Okay.
And we could work on that following plan adoption.
Okay.
So we wouldn't do a special area plan necessarily. We would look at a zoning change to the existing zoning to make it work.
Okay. Well, this is kind of a guide because they'll be bringing projects that we would approve, so.
Or not.
Give or take, or not.
Right.
Give or take here or there, there'll be a little wiggle room. It's just a guide.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone else have any thoughts? Mr. Chapman?
Yes, ma'am. Could you go back to option one, please? The comprehensive plan is a macro program. It's not micro. It's not to get into the weeds, so to speak. What I like about option one is you take out town center. It's commercial. You don't do anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
You leave it like it is. You then take the two remaining development centers and add language, as he's suggesting, but they're to be determined on a case-by-case basis. And when you start looking at individual locations, and again, we're only looking at two, there's two remaining, then we have a chance to look at each one on a case-by-case basis. And they have to go through a very exhaustive process before they even get to us. So, but it keeps the comprehensive plan in the generalities it was set out to do, but once you start looking at individual sites, they are then examined by staff, they're examined by the Planning Commission, and they then come to us. There's no way we can today determine these kind of specifics without taking away the rights of the property owners. So all I'm saying is option one gives us what I think we need, but doesn't go into a micromanaging point. So that's my feeling on it.
Does anyone have any other thoughts?
I just think that we have, you know, like, how do I put this? Like, I liked the second option. It was at C,
mm-hmm.
the second one. I liked that a lot. And the other side of that, of course, is, you know, where are all these people? I just keep thinking about all these families that are, their kids are leaving, and it's just husband and wife, and they want to stay in Mount Pleasant, but they just want to get rid of their 2,700,
mm-hmm.
Not acre. I wish my house was that big, but I can't even
think square footage.
Thank you. Oh, my goodness. And there's really nowhere to go. You know, we might be getting ready to go through that big old house on 2 acres, and, you know, where do we go? But so I like the fact that that gives us some, but I just think, Howard, that we just are not ready for any more residential. I mean, we're just not.
You don't necessarily get it with option one.
I know, but
at least we can.
It makes us feel better. Is that what it is? I mean, let's talk about it. That's interesting. It is more restrictive, right? This one tells you.
See, yeah, the limits.
It mm-hmm. limits. It has a number.
It has a max.
It's like, what do you think?
Well, I think that the cap gives potential redevelopers notice and knowledge of what the potential is. I mean, if there's no cap or no guidelines or anything like that set forth, I mean, it really could be anything.
That's what I worry about. That mm-hmm. this at least warns, that's a great word I was looking for. that's coming.
Is that it?
And I don't feel we're micromanaging, because they'll still be bringing projects, and that's what I said, but this isn't written in stone, this is just a guide, and we'll be able to.
And the comp plan can be amended, and it has been.
You know, swing a little bit here or there in numbers, I mean.
But I think that this options 2C, or two with the one dwelling unit per acre, really meets kind of what council's initial direction was, which with the net concept.
Yeah, that should be a two.
C1, C2, option CC.
I thought it was C.
So do we feel comfortable moving forward with the recommendation to council on the redevelopment centers? Should we talk about the next part of it and do it all together, or does that make sense?
Yeah, if you like that, the other piece that we were looking at is the components within the plan that identify future action steps that we need to pursue. And Ms. Hyatt questioned a number of them that deal under, they're in residential development. They're not all in this chart, but, or she didn't express a concern with necessarily all of those. But it's like looking at things in the future to be able to address and deal with future residential development will require text changes, ordinance changes in order to make it happen. And so these are not achieved merely by adopting the comp plan. So if we go to, we'll use RG12, identify appropriate locations for future life cycle and missing middle housing. This is housing in you know, different types and styles. So we, you know, and we share the, I think you've seen the missing middle spectrum. You have single family detached all on one end, and then you sort of have more mid-rise or whatever. And there's a lot of other housing types that you could consider. We have some we don't. And so what this would say is go look at that topic and see, would we want to make adjustments in our zoning or other requirements that could accommodate different types of housing types. And then our point here in this is these don't happen now. You would have to consider any of these in the future. They would be changes to the zoning ordinance if they're regulatory, because R and G are regulatory and G is for guidelines. And then so it has to go through all of that process. And then depending what you do, it might even need another step, like a special exception use for some of these, has to go through BOZA. And you may decide when you 4 years from now, when we get to the point of looking at one of these, you might say, never mind, we don't want to pursue that anymore. So it's not an automatic, is our point there. And these were just some of the pieces that supported in the plan why those action steps are there. So the question is, do you want to do anything that would change or adjust these? And these are only one page of dozens of pages of things that we're going to need to pursue in order to make the plan work.
Well, I think that the, for me anyway, the thing that would make it not needing to adjust all these sort of on an individual basis, but just to have maybe an overarching statement in this section that says something similar to what was stated earlier on, which is that that Mount Pleasant does not want to have material changes to density or its residential population. So I think an overarching statement that within these potential regulatory guidelines and changes, Mount Pleasant does not want to have material changes to the character or density of its neighborhoods. I think doing something like that would then.
And we may, there's other things that go along with this that also talk about plan policies that recognize you need to deal with context. You need to do with transitions. So even if you wanted to consider accommodating a different housing style or type, other parts of the plan say, be careful when you do that. We want to make sure we don't create harsh conflicts between lower density and maybe the next level up. So you would look and work on these all with an eye towards that opening vision statement, but we could look at saying, you're suggesting, Ms. Whitley, even further language somewhere in the action steps or in this residential piece, something that says it again?
Yeah, something that emphasizes that, because the beginning statement talked about small-town feel or small-town roots, but I think that something's a little stronger in saying, we don't want material changes to the character or density of the town of Mount Pleasant. So within any of these changes or these discussions,
that would be the touchstone as you look at any of these.
Yeah.
Right. We don't want to change the character.
We'll look and see if there's
existing neighborhoods. Like, say something to the effect that we don't want to affect the character of existing neighborhoods when we do this, and what Ms. Whitley is saying. And I think that would cover it, just to have a statement.
Yeah, again, here's one example. So you have guidelines, like for instance, the infill component we share here, when new construction takes place as infill, similar scale, configuration, the right proportions along edges, you need to make sure you pay attention to transitions, and then you need to sort of recognize where you are. So there's other language in the plan that would guide you as well, but we could look at another statement that might be, again, that more assuring or reassuring statement about that, stressing that policy direction.
Yeah, I think that would make me more comfortable with the remaining.
I know Liz is behind me. She might be writing it already.
She's got it. Okay. All right, great. Well, then do you need action from us regarding a particular, like, option 2C2?
Motion.
Do you need a motion to recommend that to council?
I would think that you would want to make a recommendation to council that you would include that
2C2.
Amended language at the beginning that gives that broad statement, that would specify what you want to do with redevelopment centers, and that also to include some additional language that you'll see at the council meeting.
Okay. Do we have any motion?
Did you need
what he said?
You need a motion. Yeah, what he said?
Yes, what he said.
Okay.
Make that motion.
So Ms. Corley makes the motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, so just to clarify, the motion would be to add language at the beginning of the comprehensive plan in the overarching vision as specified by the staff to recommend to council option 2C2, the one dwelling unit per acre gross as the cap, and require the PD rezonings and remove the town center from the redevelopment hub. And then 3 would be to put some overarching language about limiting, about not having material changes to the density or the character of neighborhoods. in fulfilling those regulatory guidelines. All right, we have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? No? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. Any opposed?
No.
All right, Mr. Howard is opposed. Okay, that's item 10. 11 is executive session to receive legal advice if needed. I don't think we need that at this point. I think we're comfortable with moving forward. Is that okay with the committee? Ms. Corley?
I think any legal advice that we receive should be to the whole council, right? That's what I'm thinking.
Okay.
Because this is going to go to...
This will go to full council on Tuesday.
Okay. And I think there is a conversation that, I mean, I worry about that. It would be good to do it, but with full council, not just us.
Okay. And then item number 12 is executive session to review the applications and recommendation members of the Settlement Communities Task Force. Do I have a motion to go into an executive session? And then post-executive session, committee may take action on any item, listen to an executive session agenda, or discuss an executive session during a properly noticed meeting. We would only be going into executive session for item 12. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
I just have a question. Do you need a second to
talk
about it?
Yeah, a second.
Second.
Okay.
Don't we have to discuss this with full council also?
Yes, I think that because there were so many applicants, and I talked with the mayor about this, the thought was that our committee, as the originator of this task force, would make a slate of candidates and then recommend that, and then full council will make the ultimate decision on Tuesday night.
Okay, I feel good about it then. Yes,
okay.
Let's do it.
All right. All those in favor of going to executive session?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, we are in executive session. Oh.
You're going to be so proud of us, because we have gone, we know, we got a list.
I have a list.
Task force?
Yes, I feel like we're going to, it's going to take us 5 hours.
I had people on my list, so I'm like, oh my gosh.
My poor husband.
We're trying to make dinner, he's trying to make Indian food, he's like, how do you cook green beans? I'm like, oh my god.
Green beans?
I was like, he's learning.
I'm like, trim the green beans.
Some garlic and oil.
I'll be upstairs, Eric. There's a legal emergency.
Is there? Oh, okay.
Right, if all the applicants.
Well done, Jeff.
Almost there.
But I think the recommendations, Mike, if you look in.
Which recommendations, Mike, the recommendations?
There are recommendations for things like, there are the recommendations that I think those action points pointed to, like the goals of.
And the affordable housing.
Exactly, and the, you know, allowing for more middle missing housing, that sort of thing. I think it's like page 3.6.
Yeah, that would be, that would be.
I think that's that section. I mean, that doesn't matter, but it just seems to me that if you're going to have one sentence, it makes sense to put it where the recommendations are from which the action points, you know.
And then you have to do all the action points in the plan.
No, I mean that, well, it just seems to me that the action points, that if you had the recommendations, the act, that you don't need them all. Well, yeah, it doesn't matter. I was just, because I remember some of the recommendations, and it seemed to me that what you were just talking about is sort of the overarching thing that would be considered when you're recommending that they look at things, you know, so it just is an idea. Look at where it is, because it may make some sense there, but.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering how am I going to get this thing embedded in my brain?
Oh, I mean, it really, my two screens.
No, you have to go back and refer to it.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. But, yeah. I mean, when any of these things come forward, what you would do is you would go back to the comprehensive plan and you would say, hey, the plan, I mean, what's the basis for us pursuing this action or that action or another action?
Right.
And you would go in and look at, you wouldn't, I mean, you wouldn't just read that one sentence in that table.
Right.
You would go back to everything in the plan and be able to, you know, use that as your guidepost for why are we even doing it.
Committee can take action on any item, but I don't think we have any motions to come from executive session. That brings us to the last item on the agenda, which is to adjourn. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.